Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm John Coffin, your host, and today we have Tim Evans, the president and founder of Evans General Contractors, with us, and Doug McCartney, the managing director and co-founder of VRA Partners. Welcome, guys. Good morning.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having us today.
Absolutely. Tim, I'm going to get going with you, and then, but Doug, feel free to make any comments as we go along. Would you describe for our listeners, Tim, the current scope of your business and what Evans General Contractors is all about?
I'll be happy to. Evans started in February the 1st, or was founded and officially started February 1, 2001, which was a big leap for me. I had been for the previous 20 years with several large global, international, and domestic contractors, primarily doing design and construct work for large corporate clients and developers and institutions. But towards the end of 2000, there was lots of change in 2000, I decided that I wanted to take some of that knowledge and see if I could do some things on my own. And I'd had the privilege of working with some fantastic firms, and they'd learned a lot from those owners, and they were all privately held companies. And so I took that knowledge and went out to a couple of small or some individuals that invested with me, and we started the company. And in 2001, the business plan was to be diversified from a product standpoint as far as what we build and do, and to geographically diversify. And I had learned that over the years. Like I said, some of the firms I'd been with, where we were in South America, the Middle East, Europe, and the U.S. So I had learned through them that having a broad footprint on the country, but also on the earth, was a big thing to do. It was important to do, so that as cyclical movements in the economy went up and down, that every cycle affects different countries at slightly different paces. So I really was focused on that, and I wanted to see our firm grow to that standpoint, which we have done today. The second thing I learned and that we employed from the beginning was to have diversity in the portfolio of work we do. So the firm started in 2001, focusing on corporate. We call it corporate environment, which is corporations, maybe Delta or Georgia Pacific or Coca-Cola, BMW, Mercedes, but we focus on the corporate needs, whether it's office, manufacturing, data centers, whatever. That's corporate environment to us. The second market is healthcare, which has been here forever and always, will be here. So even though it has cyclical movement, that's always a market that, it might be down for a couple of years, but it'll be up again.
Healthcare is always the gift that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, there's been some challenges in the healthcare industry, which caused things to slow down for 2 or 3 years. So our people, the insurance companies and the health institutions, began to find their way through the Obamacare package. Mm-hmm. And so...
enough said.
Yeah, enough said. I'm trying to be diplomatic and not take a political position. But at any rate, we do quite a bit of healthcare, and probably our single largest market segment, which is the reason that we actually grew considerably during the recession, was we were fortunate to have some very active clients that began to manufacture or to gear up for manufacturing back in the U.S. And these were, U.S.-based companies that had moved offshore, whether it was Asia or South America or India. They had moved offshore in the 80s when the labor market here began to price themselves out of the market, and they weren't competitive here. But it was a wonderful thing to see. About 2008 or 9, we began to get very active with manufacturing, but bringing companies back. Now, in the last year to 2 years, you've heard politicians talk about manufacturing, get on the bandwagon. But the uptick actually occurred in 2009, 2010. That's when it took off. And I was fortunate enough to have a gentleman named Christian Hersacker, who was a German national, who used to be previously a client for us. He came on board in 2008, and he had worked for MTU, Tognum, Mercedes, and BMW. And he was well-respected by those companies, and who knows why he wanted to come to work for a little contractor. But he came over And most of the credit for the expansion in Europe and in manufacturing should go to him. And he's built a business plan and was very successful with it. And I was very fortunate to call him a friend and also now a partner in, at Evans.
But, you know, when I think about very complex corporate environments that you're building, whether it be manufacturing or office, I guess you do a little bit of that. It seems like the team that you put on the field, so to speak, is absolutely critical. You mentioned Christian, but talk about how, you know, through the phases of a complex project, your team works together.
Well, like we were talking about before the show, it's been a learning process, even though most of us, most of the senior level people, our mid-management people, came from large organizations. Sometimes you can't take that same knowledge and apply it directly into a new company because things change. And like I told you, we had 2 years ago a huge, we had a couple of huge problem projects, which was a function of our team and our procedures that we were using at the time. Not necessarily that our people were bad, because they weren't, or the procedures, but they just did not, it was not working effectively for us. So as we were talking about this before the show, it's real important for us, we do primarily design build work, to have a very good pre-construction department and team that's not only knowledgeable with construction, but to really effectively interact with the client, you've got to understand their process, their procedure, and the product they're producing. You've got to understand that. So you have to have technically capable people, not just construction, but technically capable people that understand the client's need at an operating level. So from the get-go in a design process, we assign, you know, two or three people with different educational backgrounds, whether it's mechanical or electrical or structural. We assign them to the process. But along with that, we assign somebody who's an operations person that gets involved early on, that understands whether it's auto manufacturing, aviation, but someone who came from that world. And those are people that we've acquired over the years, and we get them involved, get them integrated, really understand the client's need, and we begin the design process. And typically the design process goes from conceptual design to design development to final construction documents. And having that same team that interacts with the clients and the user groups of the client follow the project through the design has helped us be more successful in delivering the architectural and structural design requirements of the client. And then after we all agree, we come to a contract amount. Obviously, it has to transition to what we can call a construction side or operation side. And that's when our pre-construction team hands it over to our construction team and we commence construction.
So you're really all along the way leveraging the strengths of each member on your team.
Yes, and most, and it is an investment, and it's hard to do sometimes because as an owner, you definitely have to sacrifice some of the financial gains for yourself. And you know, I've done that. I've made that decision throughout the last 13 years to make their sacrifice, because you have to go acquire those people that have those technical expertise, and they're expensive when you get a person like that. And you know, we're entering our 14th year of business next February.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
And 14 is a nice round number.
Round number. 13 was scary. And we've, you know, enjoyed the banking relationship for the last 7 years with you guys. And it's, you know, great partnership, and appreciate what y'all have done. But, you know, it's hard for most private companies to forego some of the things the ownership wants early on. But if you're willing to do that and you have some luck and you make the right decisions and build the right team, like Evans is, you know, we'll do a couple hundred million this year. But the next generation of people behind me, they can go as far as they want to go now. They've got it together.
Talk about that a little bit more. There's clearly a stage when you start something up when you're in control of everything, and that's right. And you know everything that's going on in a complicated process. And then over the years, you know, your team enlarges, and suddenly you kind of have to let go a bit of control. And that's tough for some people, because most entrepreneurs, to a certain extent,
do things better.
Yeah. They think they do everything right, and there's a control freak element to, I think, all of us.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm definitely that, and it's a battle for me, because You're right. It's when you're starting, we started with five people and $500,000. So that's a tiny, fragile thing. And, you know, everybody remembers 9/11, 2001.
Yeah.
Well, we had just started. We didn't have our foundation. And, you know, we did not have a backlog of business. So you're right. Things are very fragile. And if anything went wrong, and it did, and, you know, we were honestly just blessed to survive and weathered a scary next 12 months, because for established firms, like, once you get bigger, if something like that happens, you have a backlog, you have a considerable amount of cash in the bank, you just go through it.
Mm-hmm.
But we were very fortunate, and like I said, I truly feel blessed about that. But the transition question you're asking, it's taken us about 3 years to go through it, having the right people, and honestly, I made some selections that I would say were my fault. They weren't the employee, the potential new employee that I hired. It wasn't a cultural fit for us. And I made some mistakes, and I paid, you know, huge amounts of money for the mistakes I've made. But the group we have now, I told you before the show, I'm absolutely confident now if I got hit in a car tomorrow or plane accident, they could do it. But the transition, it's been painful. And now just realizing that some of these people do things slightly differently, but they have the same result. And I'll still get nervous. Like last night, I was going home and I was nervous about a conversation I had with a senior level manager. And his way is going to work just fine. It wouldn't be the way I did it, but the result's the same. The client will be happy. And he, as long as they don't compromise integrity, you know, like I've said this to Mara and you before, I don't look at the profitability on each job. With large corporations, we have jobs that we make a little money or no money. But if the client's happy, if you don't compromise a client's happiness and you tell me you're not going to make fee, I'm okay with that. But if you don't make fee and the client's unhappy, that's not going to work for our firm.
Right.
So we look at it a longer period of time, and it's a trust element, you know. And honestly, the key managers I have deserve it. Most of them intellectually are smarter than I am, and I mean really mean that. And they deserve to be trusted. But I have struggled with it, honestly.
That's a great place to be after 14 years, to have a team in place that you're really confident about. So you've done business in 26 states, multiple countries. Mm. Tell us one recent project that you're particularly proud of.
That's hard because there's so
many. I know you love all your babies.
Yeah,
you know,
but
there's
some neat ones, and some are different. Some of the simpler ones are actually the relationship interaction we have with the clients, very exciting. But one of the ones of my favorite of all times are just right now. Today that we have going on, or in the last 2 or 3 years? What do you want to hear?
Just anything.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Firth Rickson would be one of the biggest successes we've ever had. And Firth Rickson is a forging company. It was just purchased by Alcoa. The executive VP was a gentleman named Dave Aberry. He had five PhDs, super bright guy. He was an Army Ranger. He was an old, crusty guy. We hit it off great from day one. I walked up the first time to meet him, and I think I had jeans and cowboy boots on, and he did too. I thought he was a worker for him. He turned out to be executive vice president for him. But it was a new forging technology. It was relatively new as far as the world, and it is, they make high-stress component pieces for jet engines, for Pratt & Whitney, Rolls-Royce, and these companies. But as everybody knows, the fuel burn is the biggest thing on a jet. It's not the note on the jet. It's not the people inside flying it. It's the fuel that you fly back and forth from here to Asia or from here to Birmingham or wherever. And the technology and the equipment that we had to set in this facility, it was about $160 million facility, or $140 million, excuse me. But it was one of the eighth largest presses in the world. The press weighed just short of 6 million pounds.
Remarkable.
Yeah, and
how much concrete did you have to pour for that?
Oh, it was a crazy, very stressful job. We designed, build, fast track. We put it. The hole that it sat in was 40 feet deep, and the problem was it was after 10 feet. It was all water. We were down, this was near Savannah, so we had to. You know, we had to develop a process, sheeting and shoring, to get this hole dug and then dewater it, which is not uncommon in our business. But just the setting of the press to get it, the press was in pieces. It was in Montenegro, and it was over in Europe. So we had to get the press from there, disassemble it, get it on a ship, bring it to the U.S., bring it into the Savannah port. But once we got it here, some of the pieces were too heavy, even with a 56 tire specialized truck. We couldn't haul it over the bridges. So then we had to come up with a way of getting it on barges and floating it in and bringing it into the site and then setting it. But it was
good thing they chose Savannah instead of Atlanta.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how we'd done that. But it was a wonderful firm. We've worked for a lot of great companies, so I don't like to say that I like one. I mean, there's lots of great companies we work for. But that was a technically sophisticated, challenging job, and logistically helping Furthrix and get that up and operating. And it was, like I said, we did a phase two. Actually, my son did it about 2 years ago, and that was an isothermal press. The first press came from Germany. It was built in Germany. The Russians had it, and it was decommissioned after the Cold War, and it was sitting. The second press was made in China, and again, just getting the just communicating to make sure that we had the electrical requirements and the compressed airs and the and all the hydraulics and all the things involved with operating a 6 million pound press was challenging, but it was a successful job. Dave Hebert is a very good friend. They're one of our best references, and as I said, they were recently purchased by Alcoa.
Thanks, Tim. That's incredible, the level of complexity that you have to deal with. I'm going to shift for the time being to Doug. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, John.
Tell us about VRA Partners, another huge success story in the market, and you guys started a little bit later than Tim did, but talk a little bit about the firm and how you guys got going.
Sure. Timing is everything in life. The five partners, which is what the V stands for in VRA, and we will not talk about what the RA stands for, but that's an inside joke. We had all worked together at what was SunTrust Robinson Humphrey for anywhere from 6 to 14 years. As we were getting a little longer in the tooth in the banking environment, roles and responsibility changed. And basically the five of us really decided that we were not, no disrespect intended, bank guys, and wanted to get back to where we had really spent our careers, which is working with entrepreneurs, emerging growth, middle market companies, and really helping them sort of grow and expand and achieve sort of their life dreams, which may eventually be selling the company. So we took the task in early 2006 to wind up leaving SunTrust Robinson Humphrey all individually when the markets were wonderfully white hot, much like they are today, to start a business. And very similar to what Tim said, we started the business. Our incorporation date was June 1 of 2006, which is very helpful when you have audited financial statements and are regulated by FINRA when you're off cycle. On the accounting side, you do get a little break in terms of the audit fees. But we really started from a standing start. We put in our capital. We're a little strange organization that the five of us own 20% of the company each, which leads to some interesting discussions trying to get a super majority in terms of making firm-wide decisions. But we really started from a standing stop. We didn't bring over any clients when we started the business. Everything was very rosy. We did a lot of things that we had witnessed clients in the past focus on, such as finding office space, building out technology, and other things. And those are the things that I think we're the most proud of. But when we started the business, we wanted to make sure we did what we thought we were very good at, which is providing unbiased advice to owners, board members, could be private equity firms, any of the constituents in a business, really to help them, you know, realize their dreams and aspirations. So we're very focused in terms of the work we do. We are predominantly a merger and acquisition boutique, predominantly representing sellers of businesses. We do have a number of buy-side clients that we continue to do work with that are very large, sort of global organizations that we had previous past dealings with. And then we also, a little different than many other M&A boutiques that have somehow sprung up in the last few years, we also raise private capital for companies. And that could be simple enough for, you know, building a new manufacturing facility, investing into sales and marketing infrastructure, adding talent, but needing some capital to be able to sort of bring on that next wave of management or technical talent, depending on the business.
So when you say capital, do you mean equity capital or debt capital or both?
It could be both. In fact, there's a third sort of grouping right in between, mezzanine capital, which sort of looks like equity but is treated more like debt.
Why do they call it mezzanine?
Because it's in between.
Okay. That even almost rhymes.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not a very exciting industry in terms of nomenclature, either banking or in investment banking, which are pretty much one and the same. But the capital raises could also be to help management team members buy out an owner of a business and have a smooth transition in the business, but bringing in some outside capital sources to help them affect the transaction. Could be taking out a limited partner in a business or a minority investor in the business who may no longer be operational, but helping them find sort of the right capital mix and, more importantly, the right capital partner to work with, because it truly is a partner, especially if you've got an ongoing commitment to the business going forward. You need to pick your partner right. So we describe our business as finding the right partner for the right opportunity at the right time. And much like Tim, we probably didn't start in the dog days of bad time, but with a standing start in a business where your first revenues don't come in generally 9 months until after you started up, we had fooled ourselves into thinking that the financial crisis that was starting to peak up in New York in 2007 really wasn't going to impact us in sort of the middle market. You know, those were big companies with big problems and everything else. Hindsight is always 20/20. We should have started a little earlier in time to get a little more runway with a good economy, but we're fortunate enough to have some wonderful clients that we worked with through some difficult times and good friends that are, you know, some of those clients' partners to really get us through the tough time. So we're headquartered here in Atlanta. We are actually just north of Phipps Plaza. We have one location. Our clients, probably about half of them, are in the Southeast. We are currently selling a business in Idaho, just closed on a transaction in California, been working with a big German conglomerate that we do their divestiture work in North America. And fortunate enough for us, since we do mostly M&A sell-side work, which means you kill your client in terms of no recurring revenue, that client we've done multiple projects for as they have decided to actually divest out of the North American market along a number of different divisions that they have. So our business is fairly global. You know, the clients we work with generally are anywhere in value range, somewhere between $25 million and $500 million. We have worked with much bigger clients. And frankly, when there's a downturn, you work with smaller clients. But the nice part about it from our perspective is not only are you giving unbiased advice, because we're not selling them, you know, treasury management services, lending money, do not have a sales and trading desk, do not have a private wealth manager. We can be a trusted advisor, which is very helpful from our standpoint to be unbiased, to try to figure out, you know, what the client would like to do, what's in the client's best interest, and how that can be affected.
So, Doug, you mentioned unbiased advice, and Tim, you talked about the power of relationship. How do you make sure, Doug, that unbiased advice kind of permeates your whole institution, not only from a partner standpoint, but
in written communications? I don't think a pitch book or a confidential memorandum to describe an opportunity is actually a tangible product, and so it permeates downwards that most of the clients we work with, very similar to you, you work with, John, a lot of, you know, owner-operators of businesses, and their life savings and life work is tied up in that business. And you realize that this is a very crucial part of sort of the evolution of their businesses or their lives. And you really want to have no holds barred. We spend as much time as probably a psychological therapist through sort of, I want to sell my business, I don't want to sell my business, when is the right time for my business, how do I take care of my employees, much more so than trying to get a financial transaction done. So it is about the right partner and the right timing. So a lot of the work we do is hurry up and wait. And there are long cycles because it's a very emotional thing. that you work with clients. It's a little different when you're working with large companies like a General Electric or a Microsoft. They've got a great team of folks on hand. They can help provide a lot of that advice internally and probably could execute the same transactions that we do. Oftentimes, we're trying to educate the owner-operator in terms of what all alternatives are out there. And by not being very focused in one area or another, we can generally give unbiased advice. How that permeates down, we're fortunate enough to have a good group of younger folks that, as Tim had mentioned, in his team are a lot smarter, probably more technically gifted, especially around the computer world. And they get the opportunity to spend time with the decision makers and actually, you know, walk through a transaction where they have the opportunity to sit down and listen and participate as the owner's trying to make a decision about what's the appropriate time. And I think they realize that we all want to be entrepreneurs in some form or fashion, and you can be an entrepreneur in a bigger company. But if you sort of watch the twists and turns of the owner, I think they're educated very well to realize that everything we do is confidential, but it is the most important thing to the client at hand. And in our business, when you don't manufacture anything, it's no different than any of Tim's large projects. If you do a good job, that one, that's expected, but two, it turns out to be a great referral source. But if you do a bad job or somebody's unhappy with your service, that wipes away about 100 good things that you do. So everybody realizes personal integrity and putting the client first is important, and that permeates in our organization.
That's absolutely critical, that integrity and the commitment to client service. And it sounds like that really goes top to bottom in VRA. You both mentioned the entrepreneurial spirit, and it's interesting when you're working with clients and building client relationships that that sometimes comes through to them in an attractive way. Tim, maybe when you're dealing with larger companies, but also I'm sure, Doug, with you, when you're dealing with typically the selling or advising to a business owner specifically. Talk about that, how that entrepreneurial zeal, kind of helps your business, Tim, on a day-to-day basis.
I think it's critical. Like I said, I came from large global multi-billion-dollar construction firms, and there's a mindset that sets in whether you're in large institutional banking or you're in a large construction company or a large corporation. And sometimes you get into a herd mentality, and the herd mentality generally – no matter what industry you're in, if you have a group of people, employees that work off of a herd mentality versus being creative and pushing the envelope, you're always going to be a little bit behind because they're not going to make movements or decisions or make change strategic direction because they're too afraid to. They're going to wait for something to happen. An entrepreneurial spirit that's in a firm, and it can be in a large company. You see it in Microsoft. You see it in some of the giant firms that do well. Google, a lot of these guys, Intel, you want to get all your employees to think like entrepreneurs, and you have to give them the freedom. And again, if that is part of your culture, the benefactor of that will be whoever your client is, because, I want our folks to make decisions. And I'm not just saying this casually. I mean, I expect our people to make very large, very, significant decisions. They don't need to hit my desk. Mm-hmm. Now, if they make one or two bad ones, they're not going to be around very long. But you want them to offer the client a higher level of service, in our world, a new way, approach, or product, or delivery method even, to help their client have the best product they can have at the end of the day. But, in our firm, I'm real big on it. Like, I want them to think for themselves. We've got operating protocols that protect us, but you want that feeling that they're taking ownership of it, that if we mess something up, I don't want my people blaming the owner, blaming the design element of the design firm. No matter who makes the mistake, if you're design building, it ultimately comes back to us. And so I want our folks to realize you're managing a group of people, and if you didn't hear the right thing from the owner, that's your fault. If the owner didn't tell you, that's still your fault. I expect our people to ask the right questions and pull the information out and then to deliver that information to the other their team members. And You know, and it's an entrepreneurial presidential type unit president concept that people wrote about a lot in the 80s and 90s. A lot of the business books talked about unit presidents.
Right.
The wording's changed, but the thought process and the ownership hadn't. I mean, people put different words on it now.
And that level of accountability and responsibility is just, it's got to be there. And Doug, on your side, can you remember situations where you feel like you got hired because of the boutique nature of your business? And how does that kind of affect client delivery?
Oh, absolutely. We get hired a lot because it's very difficult to differentiate yourself in a fairly crowded universe. Our name is not the biggest brand name throughout the United States or the world on investment banking. So you've got to sort of develop expertise and ideas. But it is very nice to be able to walk into a situation. Hopefully, we have built a relationship over time before a company decides to do either a capital raise, sell the business, or contemplating that. And it's very nice to walk in and have a reference list, a transaction list of clients that you've worked with where the firm and the individuals are one and the same. And what I mean by that is when we show the list of roughly 600 transactions that we've worked on, the five principals in our firm worked on each and every one. Not everybody worked on the same projects, but it's really nice because it's really what you're getting when you hire us is not only the firm and the individual. And I think what comes clear, we made the philosophical decision to make this change to start our own firm after working with entrepreneurs in a while. It's absolutely fascinating to figure out ideas that people have to build businesses in industries and sectors with novel products, novel ideas and services. That's the fun part of what we do, and I think that enthusiasm shows when you learn about something you would never have contemplated that becomes a successful business, you'd love to learn something from the folks that you're working with. And we take a lot of that work that we do because we're very hands-on from both a senior and a junior commitment. We don't have 1,000 people to throw at a project with roughly 20 folks in Atlanta. Time is very important, but you can sort of see that enthusiasm folks have for just learning something. Sometimes we get a little concerned we may be dilettantes in a lot of different things, but the excitement is to hear
we'll call
the
you generalists, not
generalists. Okay.
Yeah.
But the enthusiasm you show for your client, you know, working through and finding some commonality either about the business opportunities or other things that are important to them, being like one of my partners who we jokingly call our hunting, golfing, and fishing partner because he's very successful at relating to people on things that are interested to them.
Tim, you may want to meet that
partner.
Yeah,
he sounds like my kind of guy.
He also wants a plane. So it's very important, although he's been a Lake Raven guy other than Lake Oconee. But he may manage to find some commonality and learn about businesses and opportunities in a very different way than I probably go about business development and prospecting. And I think that the fun part about it is you get to sit in the shoes of your client. And since the projects we work on don't happen overnight, you get to learn a lot about your clients and opportunities. And hopefully you've made some difference to try to help them achieve their dream.
That's great.
I like what Doug was saying earlier. Like, I think the most, and I tell our clients this frequently, the most fascinating thing about what I get to do is I get to see technology that you haven't even read about yet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it is so amazing to me with all the, you know, with corporate America to see the different things that are out there that, you know, you're going to see in 5 or 6 years. But, you know, they're describing to us what they're going to make or what product they're going to make and that it'll be out, it'll be delivered like in 2019 or 20. But it's really encouraging to the ingenuity and the creativity of the corporations that we build for. It's remarkable. You'd never know about it. And that's one of my favorite things.
Yeah. It's great to really both of you in your conversations with other companies are right on the bleeding edge of what's next. And that's really, really exciting. I want to shift gears a little bit, and ask you both, what's the best business advice you've ever gotten? particularly in the context of, you know, building your company or, you know.
There's a lot of, you know, I'm so grateful because I had some, I don't want to name names, but I've worked for some companies that, like I said, that were private companies, but where I watched men build, you know, billion-dollar businesses. And I have tremendous respect for those guys and a lot of great advice over the years. But one of the most simple ones that I've ever heard, and I think about every day because I'll find myself drifting off track because you get asked so many things, like not just but in your business, but in your social life and
you make hundreds of decisions every day.
Oh, every day. Mm-hmm. And when you EJ laughs at me, but when I tell somebody I'm going to do something, like last something simple, even if it doesn't relate to your business, there was a Church's Fried Chicken place in Eaton, Georgia, that I always go in and, you know, when I'm working on the farm and go get a chicken biscuit. And I told the girls that I was that worked there, I was going to bring them back a gift card for Christmas. And I had been in and out of the country and traveling, and I just hadn't done it. So the night before, I think it was the 22nd or 23rd, I remembered, and I told EJ, I said, I've got to drive, which is 2 hours down, 2 hours back. And we had a function that evening, too. And she said, you'll never make it. And I did it, and I believe the point is, even if it doesn't relate to your business, if it relates to your kids or your friends, if you tell somebody you're going to do it, as painful as it is, and there's times that things are painful, and it could be for somebody that can't possibly help you in life, but always try to do what you say. I mean, that's a simple thing, whether it's a client, your kids, somebody at work, if you tell them they're going to get a raise or adjustment or, you know, you're paying for her, them and their wives to go on a trip, do it and do it exactly when you said you would. And so that people can rely on what you say. And in our firm, I really get bent out of shape if an estimator says I'm going to have this done at such and such a date and he doesn't. Even if the client's understanding, I get upset because people rely on what you're telling them. And that's something, you know, because of technology and the computers and the iPhones and all this, people are so casual sometimes. They'll text them or say, I'm going to get to it later. I'm going to do this later. I believe do what you say, even if it's financially or time-wise painful, and do it when you told me you're going to do it. That's something that's never left me.
That's great advice, and it's obviously permeates through your firm. And when we do that, it helps everyone, yeah. And it ultimately ends up falling to the bottom line.
Yeah, they can trust you. They know you're going to do it. If you don't make as much money on this one, or it didn't go the way you wanted, do what you said you're going to do. And if it goes throughout the firm, even as I talk about from employee to employee, you know, you have the clients that you have to take care of, but in between yourselves, do what you tell the other person in our firm you're going to do, and treat them like just as important as they're the client. Have that respect level there.
That's great. Doug?
Didn't Spike Lee have a movie called Do the Right Thing?
Yeah, I like that.
The other question was, hopefully you didn't give the wonderful woman at Church's Popeye's gift cards.
No.
Given the heritage of those two organizations.
Yeah.
I've got two. One where I ignored completely, which is why I'm sitting here today. When I graduated college in 1987, was going through the interview process, and my father, who John knows, because John's father and my father somehow live in the same small town in California now, which is kind of interesting how we all connected. My father, who was in the financial services area for his entire career, said, Doug, I know you would like to go into finance. You used to love the baseball stats and focused on that, and I came home and would have prospectuses and reports, and you'd actually read some of them, usually the first page, by the way. He said, of all the things you shouldn't do is don't go into sell-side investment banking. It's a terrible business. It is so cyclical and everything else. Well, 27 years later, I have ignored my father's advice, and I think it's worked out for the two of us. Similarly, along Tim's idea, one of my former mentors at Robinson Humphrey, which was the business before SunTrust acquired it in 2001, gave me some great advice, which I try to tell clients, is follow your heart. And follow your heart means, similar to what Tim had said, in doing the right thing for your client and putting your client or the people in your organization in front of you. But it also is very helpful advice to sort of working with entrepreneurs. You can hear about Joe down the street that sold his business for some astronomical price. You can do a lot of valuation work. You can have a lot of conversations. But if your heart isn't in it, it's probably not the right thing to do. And a lot of times, folks in our industry are well known for creating a lot of technical analysis, financial analysis, which will come to an answer. But my former mentor had a thing, what we do in this business is an art, not a science. And you can have all the technical answers that point you in one direction, but if it doesn't feel right, it really shouldn't be something you do. And we have that frank conversation with the folks that work with us in that, you know, we're in a 24/7 client service business. Technology's made it a lot easier for clients to find us and sometimes to ignore us when we're looking for an answer. But if your heart is not into sort of being very good at time management skills, dealing with quote-unquote crises, which aren't really crises but are very important to your client, this may not be a business that you want to be in long-term. But if you get a rush out of having strange things hit you and through time, one, you're going to learn a lot more because I think in our business and any business, the more experience you have with the strange coming and goings only makes you better at whatever product or service you're going to provide. Your heart needs to be in it. So.
Great advice. So do what you say you're going to do and follow your heart. That's fantastic. Thank you.
And those are such simple things, but I agree with Doug. There's so many times that you can justify something because of data, and you can make yourself push to that decision because the data says so. But every time your gut will tell you, is this really the right thing? Mm-hmm. Am I really just doing it for my business? Am I really watching out for that? And I think that's huge, like, because people get this data and they justify it before they really say, hey, that's not the right. I think it's a simple saying, but it's huge in business.
That's great. We're going to shift to the speed round. I don't know if you guys know what this is, but I'm going to ask you a couple of questions just as we close, and give me some just off-the-cuff answers. Tim, what's your favorite charity?
It's the Silver Lining, which my daughter and I started in 2008, and it's a grassroots program that focuses on the cities and states that we work in, and it's been the most fulfilling thing. We don't advertise, this is the first time I've ever said it to anybody, but it's a very strong organization now and helps a lot of people in need. That's my favorite one.
Fantastic. Thank you. Doug, if you could be a professional athlete, what team would you play for and what position would you play?
Oh, very good question. You said professional. Not collegiate.
Oh, you can be a collegiate athlete too. I was thinking that as an investment banker, you'd want to get a salary for it.
No, not necessarily, because if I have that opportunity, hopefully I've got enough money in the bank to take care of the family. No, I would play for my alma mater. I'd play basketball at Duke. It didn't work out for me the first time, but I figure 32 years later, I'd be playing point guard for Duke.
You probably couldn't play forward anymore.
No, fortunately, I was slow enough but tall enough to actually get moved to point guard in high school. I just wasn't at that caliber.
Okay. Tim, do you have an answer to that one?
Really, I watch sports, but I would just say I really don't have a great answer. I mean, I went to
Georgia. You
have
a favorite team?
Actually, I do now. I went to the University of Georgia and Georgia State, but Georgia Southern is something I took up later in life. I'm on the board of trustees there, and I love watching Georgia Southern football, even though I went to Georgia State and University of Georgia.
That's great. And one more favorite movie, Doug?
Very simple. Slapshot, Paul Newman movie in the 70s about minor league hockey. So back to the sports theme.
Wasn't that the Hanson brothers?
Absolutely. Yeah, Slapshot 2, I would not recommend to anybody that came out about 10 years ago, I think, or so.
The original's always the best. What about you, Tim?
I really struggle with this one because my favorite is Lonesome Dove. It's an old movie. It's, you know, back in the 80s. But
Robert Duvall.
Awesome movie. But actually, the second would be Dumb and Dumber. So I usually, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. People say, when I say that to people over dinner or drinks or whatever, they always look at me like, are you kidding? But Lonesome Dove and then Dumb and Dumber is a funny one.
That's great. Thank you both. Before we leave, how can our listeners learn more about your firm or contact you if they have questions? Tim?
We have a very active website that's monitored daily, and you can contact us through that. EvansGeneralContractors.com. And I think it's Roswell. We have offices throughout the Southeast and in Europe, but I think it says, I think it directs you to Roswell. That's what I think it does.
Okay, great.
Doug? Ours is a little simpler. We do also have a website that we monitor all the time. It's vrapartners.com. Since we have one location, it's generally easy to find us on the website in the one building. And our main number is 404-835-1000. Please feel free to ask for me or any of my colleagues.
Great. Thank you both for joining us here today on Founders Club, sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X. We look forward to speaking with everyone and next week. Take care and have a great week.